thought it'd be a very good idea just to continue with the quiz, and I would ask the next question. And the question is, what was it they were saying right now? Unfortunately, you need to wait to find out. We're not going to replay that. It is good to be with you today, and I'm absolutely astonished at the number of connections which have already been made. First person I met this morning said, I remember you from the Maranatha Centre in Motherwell. That was a surprise. There's a lady at the back who was at Airdrie Academy when I was there as a pupil. There are people here who were with me at university. And so although this is my first visit to your church here, there are multiple connections. And of course, you know the one with Stuart, with whom I was a teaching colleague at Airdrie Academy. So it's very good to be with you and to be on your program. To some extent, I might feel this morning, or you might feel, that I'm something of an imposition on your program, because I was very thoughtfully sent the program for these days, where you're studying under a theme, More Than Gold, which is connected with John's Gospel. And you might wonder what on earth I'm doing here this morning, since I have not been asked to speak on John's Gospel. I've been delighted to do so. It's one of my favorite books, but that's not what I'm here to do. But there is a connection, and let me just suggest to you what I think it is. One of the things that always struck me about John's Gospel is that he had a great sense of clarity about what it was he was about. And one of the key verses, of course, is towards the end of the book when he says, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, and in believing you might have faith through his name. Or you might, you might have life. That's the word. Thank you. I'm getting older. You might have life through his name. And John doesn't take it for granted that people are just going to swallow what he wants them to do. And if that was true in the first century, it's even more true today. If you're a teacher in a school like this, you would understand very quickly indeed that young people won't just take it from you. They no longer see teachers as being an unchallengeable authority. And that's true in school, and it's true anywhere. People are challenging. I think that the very fact that we've got a referendum coming up is a form of challenge to the status quo. People are challenging stuff all the time. And actually, that's no bad thing. And it's true in the Christian church as well. It was true for John. It's even more true today, that if you want people to accept what you're saying, then you have to supply some kind of evidence. And John's Gospel is a book of evidence about Jesus, about who he was, what his origin was before time began. The things that he said, the things that he did, the dialogues that he had, all of it making like the math big picture of who he actually is. And today people are looking for evidence. And there are people who say to us that the Christian faith has no evidence. And so evidence, because they declare war in that area, becomes terribly important indeed. And people say the only place that you're going to get evidence is in science. And so, motivated as much as anything by people like Richard Dawkins, and recognizing that over many years we had built up some skills in the making of television programs, we decided to pose the God question and to look at the business of evidence for God. You see, science has become a very important battleground in the search for truth. There are scientists like Richard Dawkins, and we'll meet another quotation in just a moment, who say that there is no evidence for God. There is no evidence for God. So what we decided to do was to put evidence to the test, in a way, and to create a series that we called The God Question. And that's what I want to introduce to you today. And the reason I'm doing that is, number one, because I was asked to. And so I'm doing what I'm told, which you should do in a school, of course. But the second reason is that I believe that you're going to be engaging in looking more closely at this series, and so see this as something of an introduction to what it is and why one ought to engage with it. So a question that we might ask in terms of the God question, and I've given my talk today the title, Posing the Question, the God Question, is who's asking? Well, for a start, it seems to me that the Christian church should be asking the question about evidence for God's existence. We must be aware, all of us must be aware, that there is a war has been declared on people of belief. I was just watching a television program the other week, and there was just a little offside remark, a little quirk that was made. It was one of these chat show programs, and somebody said something like this: if you think you've got an imaginary friend, they get you a psychiatrist. But if a whole group of people think they've got an imaginary friend, we call that religion. And everybody laughed. You see, it's a good joke, isn't it? I mean, that's quite clever. That's pretty smart. But it's also a serious challenge, because the word imaginary says it all. There's no evidence for it. And so who's asking the question about evidence for God should most certainly include Christian people. Because we ought not to be presenting our particular brand of faith as a pill that we're asking people to swallow without thinking. It's just not right, and it just won't work. It's Christian people. But I also believe, based on my own experience, that there are millions of people across the world who are also asking the question in various ways. It might not even be particularly well articulated by those people, but somewhere in the human heart is that cry, what's it all about? That's a very familiar question to people. It happens at all sorts of times in life, not least of all at funerals, when you say, what is this all about? Or it might be walking in a fairly clear night under a starry sky and even becoming aware of some of the statistical information that was part of the quiz this morning and asking ourselves the question, you know, how can this be? What is this for? And unfortunately, people are not coming to the church to ask those questions. And that's another serious issue. It's almost a side issue, and yet it's not. Because I think that one of the reasons why people are not coming to church these days and not going to churches is because churches are not actually answering the questions that they're asking. And therefore, churches that are going to be successful, I really believe, are answering the questions that people are asking. Again, because society has changed, the pendulum has swung, and we don't set the agenda always. People themselves set the agenda. They bring the questions. And the agenda is built around the questions rather than the other way around. And sadly, churches are so busy doing what they do across our land that they're not asking and answering the questions that people are asking. And the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland begins to meet in this month at a time when the statistics are horrendous. The number of people attending church has gone from about 10% in 2003 to the last census telling us it's around 3%. These statistics, of course, are a bit like the statistics in the universe. They can be a bit vague and a bit woolly, and people have different views and so on. But we're dealing with a very, very difficult situation. But people are still asking the questions. Now, this building here behind me is actually, it's in Crieff. You might have identified that, I don't know. But it's actually empty. It's a church building, but it's not a church. But I couldn't believe it when I got closer, as you will in a minute, through the next slide, and look at that sign that says for sale on the right-hand side, there, left-hand side of the street. This is what it says. For sale, a unique development opportunity. I thought that was terrific. I mean, that I'm taking a meaning from that. Moira Robertson and I have often shared our thoughts on poetry. And that for me is a bit of poetry because it's got more than one meaning. It's a unique development opportunity. The church is empty, but folks, it's a unique development opportunity. Because if we begin to answer the questions that people are asking, then there is a real development opportunity there. Now, in terms of asking the questions, there are people who will tell you the answers straight away. A.C. Grayling wrote The Book on Your Left, and Richard Dawkins, of course, famously wrote the Book on Your Right. And the answer that they give to the God question is, there's nothing to talk about. I was having some dialogue with the National Secular Society recently, and their message to me was, there's nothing to talk about. It's done and dusted. But absolutely, of course, it is not, and the reason for that will become apparent, I'm sure. But this is a headline that appeared in the London Times just a few years ago, and I'm not going to read it for you. Please read it yourself. But if that becomes too tiresome and there are too many words on the screen, or I've not used the right color, Maima, then let me tell you what it says. It basically says, now, folks, science has got it sussed. Just as Darwin gave us a great start, so Stephen Hawking has put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, and we now know that we don't need God. Now, I could talk about this statement for quite some time, and I'm not going to, other than to say this, that it is predicated on one of the greatest fallacies of the debate that is taking place in our society. And that is that as long as you've got an explanation for something that makes sense, in other words, you can see how A led to B to C to D to E, then that is the total sufficiency of the explanation that you need. And of course, that whole thing is summed up in the approach of science programs that we get on our television. When Stuart was asking me a question earlier on, I referred to Brian Cox's tendency, not tendency, his consistent habit of not raising the God question at all. And everybody's full of oohs and ahs and wonders about the world of biology, the world of life, even the world of mind, and the world of the cosmos, of course. But they don't ask the big question behind it, which is, why is it like that? Why does it work? Why is there anything? And one of the reasons for that is, of course, that the concept of God, which really never suggests itself as an answer to these people, is a distorted concept. But sadly, it's a concept that has been pervaded, I think, often by the Christian church. And that concept is one which sees God as an old man up in the sky with a wand that waves his wand, maybe utters a few magic words, and suddenly everything is just as it is. There's no process behind it. There's nothing that needs to happen to make it like that. And I actually believe that even the Holy Scripture itself doesn't bear that interpretation. But that's my view. But that is one of the problems. My view is one thing, but I think I can fairly well assert, without fear of contradiction, this, that that concept of God turns people off all over the world. And it's turned off scientists. In the making of the God Question series, I interviewed some of the world's most eminent scientists, some of them, not all of them, atheists. And as soon as you begin to put this idea to them that God is not like that, you'd think you'd put a banana skin under their intellectual structures because they just go on the skids. They don't handle this idea that there is a mind behind the universe, an organizing, I think Graham was the word that you used earlier, architect. And of course, many Christians use the word design, the idea that there was intention behind this. That is a concept that many of them really do not handle. Now, the church to some extent has got itself to blame because for centuries there was no question. I'm going to take my watch off because I need to keep my eye on the time and I'm running a little bit late. But you gave me the service a little bit later, Graham. Can we go for that? Yeah. So you give me a few minutes beyond the deadline. Because if you go back to medieval times, questions were not, and certainly not encouraged, in fact, more than that, they weren't even allowed. And that's something that modern-day atheists have not forgotten. Sadly, Christopher Hitchens is no longer with us, and I mean that sincerely. He was one of the greatest opponents of Christian faith, but I knew him personally, and I liked him. And we had things to talk about. And Christopher Hitchens got very angry at that kind of thing, at the fact that for centuries people were not allowed to query things or to have the kind of reasoned debate that we take for granted in our society today. And Martin Luther himself had a really difficult time challenging the theology of the church, and that was only the theology. But gradually people got to the point where they no longer could take this. And something very, very important happened, and there are all sorts of good and well-documented historical reasons for it. In 1789, we had the French Revolution, which basically was a watershed moment in the history of the world, when the authority which had been propped up by the church because kings and the divine right of kings idea had been propped up by the church. So kings like Louis XVI in France could do exactly what they wanted. There was no moral framework within which they felt bound to operate. People were persecuted, tortured, no questions allowed, and eventually the fuse blew. And we had the French Revolution, which swept authority away. And built upon that, we then had the ushering in of a new era that people have sometimes called the Enlightenment. And many of you are familiar with this. This is not really meant to be a history lesson, just a reminder of certain things. And in the Enlightenment, people not only swept away authority, but they swept away the traditional ways in which people had been thinking. And so, for example, they valued reason itself, which was pretty unknown before this time. At least, not your own reason, you accepted the reasons given by other people. And so the Enlightenment stood for banishing what the word I've coined here is unreason. And God, the old man up in the sky, propping up what was clearly an unjust society, was unreason. And so we had ushered in an age that we have inherited today. That's my point. You know, people have long memories. Mud sticks for centuries. And if you were to ask some of today's foremost new atheists about this, they would tell you that they feel pretty angry about history and the way the church has suffocated thinking from medieval times. And the point is that the image that the church has today is that nothing has changed. And that is a problem that we're up against. We're up against a real problem of perception. And so these people who are religious skeptics themselves see people like you and me as religiously naive. We don't think. And whereas they will accept, they will value the supremacy of reason, they see us as accepting or having the supremacy of acceptance without evidence. That's why the National Secular Society will say to you and me today, there is no evidence. And of course, in some cases, the Christian Church still challenges orthodox science in a way that says that science is wrong because the Bible says so. Well, you know something? The science might be wrong, but you're not going to get anywhere with your argument that says the book says so, and therefore your science is wrong because the book says so. And so there's a real problem of perception. And that takes me to what I'm supposed to be talking about, which is the God question. Now, the God question series was released in 2013 as a television series and as a DVD series called Exploring the God Question. And what it tries to do, and for thinking Christian people, this is not any kind of paradigm shift, but for people who hold on to the traditional stereotypical views that the church is anti-Enlightenment, it is a paradigm shift. The God question values science, and it values reason, and it takes nothing for granted, and it invites two sides to the table, and it says, let us, as it were, and this is the first time I've ever said this, so you know what I'm saying, it's not fundamental to what we're doing, but it's a way of expressing it. It says, in the spirit of the Enlightenment, if you like, in the spirit of enlightened thinking, let us put our heads together and actually let's look at the evidence. Now, the word evidence, of course, needs a little bit of definition, because sometimes when people talk about evidence, they mean scientific evidence, that which seems to prove something. Though even in science, that's a very difficult definition to maintain with any degree of consistency. But when people throw out God, it's very often because they believe that there is no evidence. But you know, most of life, the vast majority of things in life, are not based on scientific evidence, but rather on balance of evidence. And the God question asks you to make a judgment, looking at some of the scientific evidence, but then making a balanced judgment based on what you've seen. And it asks you to consider this question. Does what you learn about the cosmos, about what science says about life and evolution, and about what we know, and it's not a great deal, about mind and consciousness, on the basis of those three themes, does it seem to you like we're the products of chance or intention? Now that is a very important question. We have moved a long, long way away from the idea of the old man up in the sky. And so we are asking a philosophical question, a serious question that is worthy of investigation in the 21st century. Is there evidence of intention behind what we're doing? And if so, that begins to establish the case for the creator of the universe, the maker, the God whom Christians worship. And so it's not the imaginary friend, but actually the answer to the biggest question in the universe is how can it all be explained? And so there are these three themes in the series, and I believe that next week you will look at part one of the first program, because in the DVD series it's 6 half-hour programs. I said this is a television series, and we're working hard to get this on television in the UK, and we're not succeeding yet. I think we might in time. But it is a television series in many other parts of the world, and so far has gone to 300 million homes. In Norway, for example, where it was transmitted in January, the response to it was such that the NRK, the national broadcaster there, retransmitted it in February and will retransmit it in October. And so people, it seems to be scratching where people are itching. If I've got that around the right way. Sometimes I tend to say itching where people are scratching, which is the wrong way around. I think we got it right. Because people are understanding that it's a serious look at the evidence and asking a question that scientists like Richard Dawkins is not prepared to ask. And the series is also on DVD, as you know. That has gone into 23 countries in English and being used very extensively. And it's being used in two ways. It's being used by Christians to familiarize themselves with the arguments and the evidence, and so that they can reflect upon, well, I'll tell you what I think, reflect upon the incredibly strong evidence, and indeed I would say necessity, for there to be a creator of the universe to provide such sophistication and wonder as you discover in these programs, and indeed as Orthodox science has discovered. The programs are also going into schools. We've already run a national conference for teachers in Scotland in this, and I attended a sixth form conference recently. I was only asked to speak for 10 minutes, which was wonderful, because the school had it all handled. 100 young people in Caldervale High School studying the God question for 4 hours, because it's balanced. Because it treats people in the spirit of the Enlightenment, if you like, as reasonable people who are entitled to make up their own minds about things. And it's now going into other languages as well. Spanish is presently in translation. And Spanish schools have become aware of this, and a teacher from Caldervale High School is going to Madrid in July to take part in a national teachers' conference to talk about how the God question has been used in schools in Scotland, and to encourage Spanish teachers to do the same. And so these are very important things that are happening. We are very much aware that we have a job to do in the Christian church, a development opportunity, as the sign said earlier on. And it seems to me, in order to do so, we have to start really showing that we treat people's questions seriously. We're not folk who stick our heads in the sand. We're people who are prepared to ask hard questions and stand up and try to answer them. And so what's happening as people are exploring the God question is that Christians are understanding the value of that exercise, and they are learning. Apologetics is sometimes the word we use for it. Not that we're making apologies, that's not what the word means. But it's apologia, a defense. We're able to defend our view. But you know, we can do more than that. And that's something that's terribly important to me right now in my life. I'm not only interested in defending something I believe. I'm interested in challenging unbelief. Because I actually think that atheism is a totally irrational conclusion to reach, given the sophistication of what orthodox science has revealed. And can I just say this about orthodox science? This is a terribly important thing. It's a point that some people don't get, and I understand it, and it can cause upset. This series actually is not saying, it's not giving any kind of endorsement to orthodox science. It isn't. Why? Because I'm not a scientist, and I produced this. The big issues about the science are for scientists to discuss, it seems to me. What we're really asking in this series is, assuming that orthodox science has a great deal of truth to it, does that look like we are the products of chance or intention? So let's just assume that orthodox science is true. It doesn't ask you to believe it. It's asking you if even orthodox science suggests, an interpretation of it suggests, that we're the product of chance or intention. And so I think that's a terribly important thing. You see, orthodox science may be completely wrong. God might have made the world in six literal 24-hour days, and the world might only be 6,000 years old. That is possible. Doesn't look like it from the science. But it's possible, because I don't know. And you know what? Probably neither do you. And so we mustn't find ourselves drawn into the wrong debate about whether or not the science is true. We must nail the debate elsewhere, which is that even if the science is true, what does that say about God? And that is what is so very important about this. And so we are wanting also to challenge atheism. I'm going to say more about that in a minute. I won't be very long. The series brings atheists and theists together, as well as a number of additional experts. So you really learn about the science, I can assure you about that. And we ask questions like these, and forgive me because the time really has gone, I'm not going to read them out. But as you go through the series, program by program, these are some of the big questions that we ask, and to which God might somewhere along the line really be an answer that satisfies people. We're finding in our own personal contacts with people who are non-believers. Do you know, I came across a phrase recently, which I have now just taken and used as my own, but I'm attributing it to somebody else, but I don't know who it was. I came across this concept, people of unfocused faith. We tend to polarize, don't we? We put people into categories, believers and non-believers. But there's another category, it's a huge category out there. People who are not satisfied with atheism, not satisfied with just being some kind of material cog in a great machine of nature that's got no rhyme or reason or purpose or meaning. They're just not happy with it, and I understand why. And those people are there in their millions, and we've met some of them and seen the change that takes place as they understand that you can move from a position where you've thought there was no good reason to believe because you've read the media, you've heard it from academia, you've seen it on TV, you've read the God delusion, and there's no good reason to believe. And suddenly you discover, yes, there is. And that faith can become, that potential faith can become more focused. If you're really going to be serious about this, I would suggest that you get the booklet that goes with it, the study guide. But that's another story. There's a leaflet at the back that tells you how you can do that. Let's move towards our conclusion. Each program offers an open verdict. It's not for me to tell people how to conclude. We present the evidence and people must conclude for themselves. But I would point this out to you, and it should be no surprise if Christians see in the wonders of creation the hand and imprimatur of the Creator. Because Paul in Romans 1:20 tells us that actually, although it's not the main reason why Christians believe, because that would be focused upon God's revelation through his Son, Jesus Christ, and the cross. That's when the rubber really hits the road. But for a lot of people, this priest stuff needs to go on. And Paul tells us that you can get somewhere with this, that you can look at the wonders of creation, and there you can not only see the hand of God, but I've always been intrigued by this statement in Romans 1:20 that tells us that his eternal power and divine nature, it's not just a designer, but his eternal power and divine nature. You might want to reflect on that in your meditation this week. What on earth does that mean, that as we look at the wonders of creation, something of God's divine nature can actually be seen? And then we read these words this morning, and Graham read them earlier from 1 Corinthians, that God has made, put in the form of a question, foolish the wisdom of this world. The wisdom of this world says, God is your imaginary friend. Give it up, folks. Stop treating the world like a place of buffoons. It's time, that's what atheists tell me, it's time we stop being children and grew up. And that is the foolishness of the world. And what we're about is trying to challenge that and to trying to introduce the idea of God's wisdom. Now, it's a process. And sometimes I think we should just stick to making television programs. But for some reason, we've been doing more. And particularly in Scotland at the moment, we are trying to marshal a lot of support to challenge atheism, to equip the church, and to challenge atheism. So thank you for the fact that you're going to be encountering this stuff soon, and thereby having the first toe on the first rung of the ladder. What we are doing in two events in June, two things, because we get two audiences. One is the general audience, and the other is church leaders. And on the 5th of June, we have an event in the Glasgow Thistle Hotel called Grasping the Nettle, and Professor John Lennox is going to be the after-dinner speaker there. And I know Stuart Mitchell has got a table there, and I don't know if all the places are taken. But anyway, he'll talk to you about that. But this is about encountering it from a master himself, who's one of the chief exponents in the science-religion debate in our world, and has debated atheists all over the world. So he's our guest speaker on that evening. And our audience is church leaders and others, but the leaders are terribly important, because we want leaders to lead their congregations to see the sheer importance of addressing these issues. So that's what Grasping the Nettle is about. In Concert with the Cosmos is very different. It's trying to attract people from everywhere to the subject. And part of the attraction is to put it in a wrapper of entertainment. And so we have got spectacular music in this event. It really is, it's sacred, it's secular. It's all of it a celebration, however, of the cosmos. It's like a television chat show that's going on in the background with lots of music and raising the question. You know what it is by now, don't you? Does it look like we are here as the products of chance, blind chance, or the products of intention? You may want to think about that. That's really the purpose of the concert. And we want to go on to do other things. We want to challenge atheism. We want to have the Christian worldview represented in our media. And we're working on that. And starting in Scotland. And we want to have some public debates as well. It's time the Christian voice was solidly heard. It has a rational basis. Of course there is faith, but atheists have faith as well. Not in God, but in other things. And I'll leave you with this thought. I probably shouldn't, because it's going on to another subject, but I can't help it. It's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible these days. As Elijah stood on Mount Carmel, talking to a group of people, could be our country, people who once knew God, strayed away, worshipping Baal or Baal, I never quite know. If anybody knows how you pronounce that word, let me know at the end. I was brought up with Baal. And Elijah says, if the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. You know what the next sentence is after that? And the people said nothing. And the people said nothing because it was only a proposition. And the problem with the church is sometimes we've just got propositions that are not backed up. And then Elijah said, let's put this to the test. And you know what the people said? That's good. This is good. You read it in 1 Kings 18. That's what they said. I like that idea of putting it to the test. And so Elijah did, and you know the story. You know what the people said next? The Lord is God. Because they saw the evidence. They saw the demonstration. And it's not all about demonstration, but neither can it all just be about believe it because I say so. There's a compromise in there somewhere, isn't there? There's a balance we've got to reach. It's also about the revelation of God. We understand that. But we mustn't say farewell to rational reasons for belief in a wonderful God, a creator, who sent his Son into the world and sent him to the cross so that we could be finally united with him. Forgive me for taking license and going a little bit over the time. Blame Graham for giving me it 30 seconds late. But thank you for your interest, and please join us at In Concert with the Cosmos if you can. We need your support. We're doing some very brave things. And if you are in conversation with non-Christians about any of these things, please get them there. I offered to buy an atheist a ticket the other day, and I meant it. I want lots of atheists there, and many of them are coming. A colleague of mine was getting her car valeted. Don't know how she can afford that, and I can't, but car valeted, and the guy who's valeting the car was the owner, saw a leaflet in the back of the car. What's this? I'm an atheist. He's coming to the concert, and he's bringing some of his friends. And there are lots of people like that. We've got to go on the move, folks. We've got to go on the move. We've got to answer the questions that people are asking, and we've got to demonstrate that Jesus Christ is alive and that this is what makes sense of the whole thing, that there is a God in heaven and we can have a relationship with him. I can't think of anything else that makes sense. Otherwise, it's all just chance. And what child of the Enlightenment is actually going to swallow that once they've heard all the evidence? Thank you.